Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Good evening, listeners, brave navigators of the enigmatic and the concealed. Have you ever felt the pull of the unanswered, the allure of the mysteries that shroud our existence? For more than a decade, a unique comic publisher has dared to dive into these mysteries, unafraid of the secrets they might uncover. This audacious entity is Paranoid American. Welcome to the mystifying universe of the Paranoid American podcast.
Launched in the year 2012, Paranoid American has been on a mission to decipher the encrypted secrets of our world. From the unnerving enigma of MKUltra mind control to the clandestine assemblies of secret societies, from the awe-inspiring frontiers of forbidden technology to the arcane patterns of occult symbols in our very own pop culture, they have committed to unveiling the concealed realities that lie just beneath the surface. Join us as we navigate these intricate landscapes, decoding the hidden scripts of our society and challenging the accepted perceptions of reality.
Folks, I've got a big problem on my hands. There's a company called Paranoid American making all these funny memes and comics. Now, I'm a fair guy. I believe in free speech, as long as it doesn't cross the line. And if these AI-generated memes dare to make fun of me, they're crossing the line.
This is your expedition into the realm of the extraordinary, the secret, the shrouded. Come with us as we sift through the world's grand mysteries, question the standardized narratives, and brave the cryptic labyrinth of the concealed truth. So strap yourselves in, broaden your horizons, and steel yourselves for a voyage into the enigmatic heart of the Paranoid American podcast, where each story, every image, every revelation brings us one step closer to the elusive truth.
Hello, all you Paranoid Americans out there. And if you're watching this, FYI, you can be listening to it. This is actually an audio podcast too. And I guess now if you're just listening to this, you can also watch it if you just go on YouTube or go on Rumble on one of the other places. Almost all the episodes I've been trying to do both audio and video. So I'd appreciate the support. Even if you don't want to watch it, hop on and give a like and do all the things. And today I've got an interesting guest, Todd Cave. Shout out to Heidi Love, which I do monthly Mormon Mondays with. She introduced us, and I'm glad she did. We spent over an hour, maybe a couple hours last week, just talking about a bunch of ancient philosophies and how it ties in with like modern religion. And so now we're going to do a version where we record it and let you listen in on it and kind of explore a little bit more. So anyways, welcome aboard, Todd, and let people know where they can find you, if you even want them to find you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Todd Cave, and I'm an online fitness trainer. And in my spare time, I talk about all these kind of things, mostly consciousness, spirituality, the state of the world, religion, all these very thought-provoking subjects that wins you no friends. But it is information that right now, where we are in our ascension in humanity, it is a message that very much needs to be said. And if anyone is interested in seeing some of my work and stuff like that, because I'm a fitness trainer, so I help spiritually inclined people burn fat and build muscle, you can find me on Instagram at Adriano_246 or on Facebook with my name, Todd Cave, TODDCAVE.
And I detect a strong accent. Is that Texas? Is that where I'm hearing? Texas?
No, actually, I was born in Barbados, and I lived there for half of my life, and then the other half I spent in the UK. And because of that, my accent is very mixed, and I used to work with a lot of Irish and Scottish and people from Newcastle and stuff, so basically Northerners, and I ended up picking up a lot of their twang. So my accent is quite mixed, is Caribbean based, yes, because I'm from Barbados, but you know, living abroad for so many years, you know, you tend to tweak your accent, because when I first went to England, a lot of people struggled to understand me. So I learned how to curve, always say things and pronounce my THs more, so that there's no think and thank you, is thank you and think. So although when you go to Ireland, most Irish people don't pronounce their THs. So, you know, it is just another accent. But I tend to, when I'm speaking in, you know, capacities like podcasts, you know, in settings where it's semi-formal, you know, I tend to pronounce my THs and stuff. It's only with family and friends from Barbados that, you know, you speak more colloquially, you know.
It's funny you mentioned Ireland in there, because I did a show recently with my friend Gordo from Those Conspiracy Guys, and he was giving us a sample of how he also has to, like, I don't know if it's like code switching or like adapting, but like he was telling us that our accents were really strong, and obviously I don't hear my own accent in Florida, but I've got one. But he was like, yeah, I actually have to enunciate myself differently when I'm talking to somebody that's in the States, and we asked him to give us an example, and you know, like just like Irish, and it was just like there was no consonants. It was just like all like the vowels and the R's, and that was it. Vowels and R's, and you got to figure out what words were being said in between just those. And it's an interesting experience. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And if you're from Northern Ireland, from a place called like Tyrone, it's even worse. It's almost, you think it's a different language, almost. So
what's the best language? Out of all the languages that you've had heard, even if it's just accents, but like, are there some that feel like you relate to them more?
That's an interesting question. I would say I tend to favor Portuguese, but European Portuguese. It is a very sophisticated sounding language to me. A lot of Portuguese people say that it sounds like a Russian drunk Spanish person. You know, no, a drunk Russian speaking Spanish. That's how they describe all Portuguese sounds, because there's a lot of zh and sh, and you get the h sound as well for the r, or you get the double r, which is r as well. So the two variants to pronounce the r, which is like a h sound, or the Spanish r. So yeah, they always say it sounds like a drunk Russian speaking Spanish. So that's the language that I found the most interesting to me. European Portuguese.
The type of stuff that we were talking about before was kind of about forming together the origins of our modern day culture and religions. And a lot of the time that stuff gets traced back with semantics, and not just the spelling, but like the enunciation of certain words and how you pronounce the different ones. And since you've got more experience than I do in different languages and different dialects, how much credit do you give to like this word in this region sounds a lot like this word in this region when they're two completely different words but they sound the same? Usually in this area, people take that as almost proof that there's a connection between those two. And I'm just curious, do you feel that there's a connection between words that sound the same but mean different things?
Yes, I really do think so. And when you go back and when you look back at ancient times, we all used to speak one language. And if you look at the story in the Bible, and then when you look at and you compare it to also other texts like the Sumerian tablets, you see that there was a unity that man had. And then events happened and there was a split in humanity where they changed our languages. Because even the story in the Bible, it says, I will confuse man so that he no longer speaks the same language. And where that came from is that according to the story in the Bible, the humans were building a tower because they wanted to go to war against God. And God was very upset about that. But the original text shows that basically humans started to realize that they were being enslaved and they were trying to go to war against God. And it was the Tower of Babel seemed to have been, it could have either been a launch pad for a spaceship or it was some sort of device for some sort of energy or something, right? We are not 100% sure, but it looks mostly like a launch pad for a spaceship. And what it was is that man was going to go to war against, quotation marks, God. And when they changed the languages, because the Anunnaki, which we'll talk about most likely, when they split up humanity into like different sections and tribes and put their mark on humans, what they did is that they systematically changed words. So you would have words that may be spelled the same but pronounced differently. You will have words exactly what you say, maybe sung the same but written differently. And it is because they had like a base language. And what it is now is that it was this separation of the languages and instilling different religions and different meanings to words, and then also adding more meanings to words, because I was doing a little bit of research on the English language. And it's quite interesting, the English language, because the English language is 29% Norman-based, which is Old French, which would be, we'll call, Latin-based. And then it's 26% Germanic. So what happened is that in 1066, when the Normans, who were French, they conquered England, they brought their language with them. And with them, they brought many different words. So, for example, in English, you have a word called mutton, which comes from the French word mouton. But then in Old English, there was the word lamb. So what ended up happening is that you have two words for the same thing. And it looks like if the two words were used is that the lower class people that were more like the Anglo-Saxons, they spoke more of the old Germanic, old English. Because old English is completely different from what we speak now. You wouldn't even be able to read it, to be honest with you, right? But a lot of those words, the normal folks use. While the upper class, they were more nobles, etc., the aristocrats, they were more French speaking. And what it is that they use those words. So what ended up happening is that you would have two words for the same thing. This is where you get begin and commence from. It's the same thing. So in English, we have like two words for the same meaning. And it seems to be similar to how you were saying that you would have words that may look the same but pronounced differently or spelled the same but have completely different meanings. And it looks like if this was deliberately done to sort of like confuse man, because when you really look at it, there's a lot of semantics of words and there's a lot of word gymnastics that has been performed on us to make us think in a certain way. And even words like understand, in truly what it really means that you're under the person, but you're understanding them. You should actually be over them, so overstand. So this is why you hear some people, very, very rare, but you would hear that they would say, I overstand it. Because if you overstand it, you're on top of it. You're able to speak about that thing because you're standing on top of it. So there's a lot of play of words that has been done, which is one of the reasons why we're not as knowledgeable as we really think, you know?
What do you think about, like, I don't know, binary code being the new universal language, like computer code? Because that's all, if we're in Germany or if we're in China or if we're in Texas, for the most part, that's the exact same language. And that is a way that we maybe like through machines, but it is a universal language, kind of like Tower of Babel might have been working on to go to war with God. So I'm just curious what you think about that.
It is very similar to what we have called the Adenkra codes. The Adenkra codes are what you call self-correcting codes of the universe. And the fun fact for you, the Mali tribe, the Dogon, they actually had those codes that were given to them by their god, who was a fish god. And those gods were called Enomo. And they would have these prints on their shirts, and they would have like things designed in these codes. So the person that was very, he was very much at the forefront of developing the internet. He learned that the Adenkra codes that these Dogon tribe have, and the code that is actually used to create the internet, are actually the same codes, the self-correcting codes of the universe. So what you're talking about binary, I'm not surprised, because basically the geometry and the coding of the universe are things that we are only now starting to understand. This is the coding that will be able to create multiverses, because they tell us a lot of truth in the movies. So when you look at Doctor Strange, and when he was in that car crash, how he became Doctor Strange, and you saw that at different multiverses or different dimensions, he would be dead in one, and then he would be trying to save himself in other universes and stuff. So yes, these binary codes you're talking about are very fundamental in terms of creating new paradigms, new dimensions, and unlocking the keys to the universe in reality for us.
Do you think when the Dagon talk about the fish gods, are we talking like a literal fish god that's got scales and like needs to be in the water and stuff? Or do you think that's like been a mistranslation?
Well, we don't know 100% for sure. But what we do know is that the fish god that supposedly saved them is more likened to Enki, which is one of the Anunnaki gods that helped create humanity. And one of Enki's symbols was the fish. So this is where you get the Catholic Church have on their hat, you have a fish's mouth where it's open. So an Enki symbol in the Sumerian tablets was that of the fish. And he was always the one that had water, or was associated with water. So this is where he's very much associated with Poseidon for the Greeks, who was also the god of the water, right? So we don't know 100% if it was an actual fish, but from what it looks like and the way the depictions, and also I remember I had a very, this part here is supposition, but I'll tell you where I'm getting from with this. I had a dream when many years ago actually, and all the movies that they have showed us with these and the imagery of the pharaohs and having all of these like different heads, it appeared in my dream that they were just headdresses that they could take off, right? So what I would say is that I'm very much inclined to say that they are not necessarily gods like fish like that. But when you look back at the Sumerian tablets and all of that stuff, what we do know is that they impersonated certain characters. So like Marduk was like the bull. So he was always with the horns, you know, or the ram. And Enlil was the eagle. So this is where you will see on a lot of crests and flags, you see the double-headed eagle or the single eagle. The American flag, single eagle. You have the Russian coat of arms, double-headed eagle. You have countries like Azerbaijan, Egypt, etc. They all have eagle. So we know we can track these gods and these beings through their symbology. I am very much inclined to say that they are advanced humans because you see in the pre-Hispanic times, in the pre-Columbia, Grand Columbia, when as it was known before, you find some of these artifacts where you will see like a person, someone that looks like a person in a spaceship with a spacesuit and a helmet and stuff. And even in the Emerald Tablets, it talks about, not the Emerald Tablets, the Sumerian Tablets, it talks about they put on a headgear. I can't remember the exact word that they would use, but it would basically describe like a helmet. And we know that they had sex amongst one another. We know that they ate, they drank beer, they created humans according to them. So I would say they put on their pants one leg at a time. So I would say that they are probably at least a million years more advanced than us in terms of knowledge and science and technology?
This is like a devil's advocate question, right? But it's one that I've heard before, and I'm just always curious what people's answers are to this. So in the example that you gave with the equal gods, and I've heard this applied to deities that relate to owls or to snakes, there's one mentality of that this is almost evidence that these gods are all the same god and that they've all kind of spawned from a root culture or root religion, so that whenever you see an eagle god somewhere in the world, you can kind of trace it back to some sort of prototypical eagle god. The other side of that coin would just be that since eagles exist in two different places on the planet, that two different cultures that haven't interacted both look up and see eagles and are amazed by them, and then develop their gods to be based on the things that they're observing individually versus being any connection between those two. I'm constantly struggling between those two ends of the extreme. Like, did two cultures spontaneously come up with similar ideas because we all have the same human brains and we're observing some of the same animals in nature? Or is it that, you know, it all started with the one eagle god and the eagle god spread around to all the different cultures?
Well, I tend to not be so rigid in my thinking like that. I look at it as, yes, for example, Enlil, he was Lord of Command, Lord of the Air. And his symbol, he took on the eagle symbol. Now, what I would say is that the eagle also represents a certain type of consciousness. So I look at it as more, the eagle represents Enlil, and also it represents the warring consciousness. So when you look at all those countries that have the eagle in their coat of arms, their flag, or their crest, they tend to be very warring countries. And those what I would call the Enlil faction or the Enlilites. And when you look at, say, for example, and a classic example is if you look at the Mexican peso, you see that there's an eagle with a snake in both its mouth and its claw. And what that represents is the eagle consciousness conquering the serpent consciousness. Because we've been very much misinformed that the serpent is bad. So they always tell us about Satan, that old serpent, etc., etc. But when you look back at the original text, which are the Sumerian tablets, the story that is being told is the story of Enki actually giving humans consciousness. He's telling us that the god of the garden, which was Enlil, he was also known as Lord Satan, he was not the creator of the universe or the creator of all things. And he told Eve these things. So what it is now is that the serpent in that particular story, which was transliterated into the Bible, is really to represent the giving of consciousness to man at that particular time. But what's happened is that it has been a lot of connotations have been put and a lot of narratives have been installed into religion to make us think that the serpent tempted Eve to eat the apple of the tree of knowledge, good and knowledge, the apple of good and right and wrong, or good and bad. And but in reality, that was not really the situation. So the serpent, for most of history, that when you do the research, always seems to have been the giver of consciousness. And this is represented in Mesoamerica by the plume serpent. And the plume serpent was actually the symbol that Thoth the Atlantean, who's the one that built the pyramids in Giza and built, I would say, the pyramids around the world because they're similar construction. He took that symbol, and the story is that he was educated by the serpent consciousness. So his teachers were serpents. So he tended to take on that symbol and that moniker. So when you look at the peso, the serpent consciousness is being taken over by the eagle consciousness. It was conquered, right? And this is the symbolization of the conquistadors coming to Mesoamerica. So the Spanish coming to Mesoamerica, and the Portuguese as well, but the Spanish came to Mesoamerica and took over. So all of the things in terms of the languages, the culture, the rituals, the traditions, all of those things have been almost wiped out. And that is a symbolization of the eagle, the warring eagle, the dominant strong eagle taking over the consciousness of the serpent, which was more loving and kind. And when you see the and there's even more to that story as well, because they have tribes like the Aztecs who were very, very warring. But when you actually look to see who was their god their main god was a god called Huitzilopochtli, or Huitzilopochtli was the sun god for them. And Marduk was the god in Babylon, who was also known as Moloch, who demanded blood sacrifice and also child sacrifice and everything. So this is why the Aztecs had that particular way of being. So to elaborate more on your question, what it is that humans have actually been taught all of these things, because when you go back in history, you see that there was almost like this steady line in the progress and the development of humans. And then it was just like this big, big jump where one day we just knew how to do this and do that, make fires and to make weapons and stuff. And there are books like the Book of Enoch, Enoch 1, that talks about Azazel. He's the one that taught humans how to make war. He taught the women how to do face painting, aka makeup. So the humans were literally taught by these extraterrestrial beings how to do everything that they're doing now. So this is why there's nothing new under the sun. So it looks like it is more, yes, for sometimes you can tell it is the person, like in this case, Enlil would be represented by the eagle, but also by the consciousness of the people that follow him, just like the consciousness, because you see like Quetzalcoatl, Kukulkan, Viracocha, they all had the plumed serpent. So how can it be that all these people had the same symbology? And then if we go to China, this is represented by the dragon, which is a derivative of the plumed serpent. So there's certain types of consciousness that it looks like, so it's not fixed necessarily of a person, but a way of being, a way of thinking.
Do you think at any point in history that any of this was literal? Like there was a literal plumed serpent at some point, or was that just like a symbol that was created to represent something that got spread around? Or because in my mind, how do these disparate different cultures all have the same symbolism? And it's either not to limit it to just a few, but like the three that make the most sense would be spontaneous. They all just spontaneously came up with different things that happened to be the same, like three people came up with the same song without knowing each other, or one of them started first and it disseminated outwards, or there's literally plumed serpents and they were all seeing the same plumed serpent.
We don't know 100%. So anyone that can come and tell you 100% it is that would not really be telling you the truth. It could be allegory, it could be literal, or it could be just to represent certain consciousness. Now, what you're saying is very true, because what it shows is that either a person or a group of people with similar consciousness and mindset went on different parts of the planet and taught these things. Now, we have some evidence to show that this is the case, because when Thoth and Marduk went to war, after Marduk won, Enki, his father, it was their father because they're both brothers, told Thoth to leave Egypt, or at the time it was known as Kemet or Kam, and go and restart civilization. And he went to Mesoamerica. We know that. And he took his high priests, who were black Africans known as the Olmecs. And they were high priests that came to Mesoamerica and taught these things. We know that the stories of the flood, we have Aborigines, the Hopi, we have the Dogon, We have even people from other parts of Mesoamerica seeing the exact same tale, slight variations, but they're seeing the same thing, that a God came and saved us, right? So what we have then is that either one person or a group of people aligned with a certain type of consciousness saved certain groups of people on Earth, which would be very much why the stories, like what you're seeing, are very similar in terms of maybe like a song or something, because it is from the same consciousness, the same group of people or one person. We don't know 100%. But what I would say is that there are a lot of stories that are very similar. So this is why you have, for example, the pyramids in China, the pyramids in Mexico, and the pyramids in Egypt are all aligned to Orion, all of them. And they all are within the same similar type of construction. You know, just that the pyramids in Mexico are 50% or half the size of the pyramids in Egypt, but it's similar construction.
The flood one makes the most sense to me, that if there really was a literal global flood, then of course you're going to have every culture with some sort of a flood tale. So that one is the most approachable, I think, that you could almost win anyone over, that yes, a global flood occurred at some point, which is what spawned all these. But I'm more interested in how literal some of the more specific claim, like for example, when we say snake consciousness, right? In a practical, or maybe like a less practical sense, but if people were literally talking to snakes at some point, and like an actual snake type creature or like a visual snake entity was seen conveying information, or like that whole you know, cunning as snakes or sly as snakes and all this, if that had some basis in physical reality, that snakes were conveying knowledge, then it would make sense if completely different cultures that maybe didn't talk to each other for long amounts of time all have similar archetypes in the snake consciousness, right? But it's harder for me to think that that three different cultures would all land on, oh yeah, a snake consciousness means this type of consciousness. Whereas, like, what if one culture said snake consciousness is like being friendly, and another one was like, no, snake consciousness is lying all the time, and another one was like, no, snake consciousness just means that you like to hang out on the ground, or like you eat bugs or something. Like the chance of completely different cultures not only adopting the snake as specifically conveying knowledge, like, the only two explanations are either the snakes really did it at some point, or again, it came from one source that got disseminated all over the place. And there's almost like a missing link of spreading culture, like a Johnny Appleseed of culture that went from, you know, from the east to the west. So I'm just, does that ring true with you at all about like the snake aspect? Or do you think that there's a chance that the different cultures all landed on the snake because there's something inherent with like serpent energy in particular that it's like they didn't have to communicate with each other?
Well, I look at it completely differently, where I think it was one being or beings that are aligned with the serpent consciousness that went to different groups of people on Earth and taught them these things.
Well, what does it mean to be aligned with serpent? So if a god shows up at my front door and I start conversing with him, even if he's aligned with serpent energy, like how does that get impressed on me to where now I'm like, oh, this guy's got serpent energy? Because as a bumpkin, you know, I don't know what serpent energy necessarily means or how I would even identify it versus dolphin energy.
Well, serpent represents the giver of consciousness. So in all of these cultures and groups of people that would revere the serpent or the snake, it is because they see the serpent as the giver of consciousness. So when you look back at the symbology, it was Thoth that was the serpent. He took on the serpent moniker. So when he left Egypt, because in Egypt he used to have the abyss head, you know, that bird with the very, very long beak. When he went to Mesoamerica, he transformed himself and he adopted the plumed serpent. So basically, we know that the plumed wing, basically wings, always represented a higher level of consciousness, right? So the plume serpent is a representation of the giver of higher levels of consciousness. You understand? So what it is now is that when all the traditions, all when you really delve deep into it, the serpent was always signified as the giver of consciousness. So what it is now is that we had beings that were highly spiritual beings, very highly advanced beings that went to different parts of the world. So this is why you would have similar mindset. It's just like if, for example, if you taught me to cook a particular dish in a certain way, and I traveled to different parts of the world and taught people to cook that particular dish exactly the way you taught it, then now your knowledge would have been transferred to other parts of the world. So it's very similar to that, where there were beings that were very much in alignment with a certain type of consciousness, and they went to different parts of the world, and they took on that moniker of the serpent, which really is the giver of consciousness. So for the people, they always saw it as like, the thing is, right, is that you forget humans were very, very primitive at that time. So if you see a person that has maybe like a skin on them that has like maybe like a coat that looks like fish scales, we don't know what the reason is. So we will call them a fish because we don't have the consciousness to and the level of understanding. It's just like if you travel back 1,000 years ago and you have a lighter and you tell someone that you can make fire and you just pull this thing out of your pocket and light it, these people are going to be like, oh my gosh, this guy creates fire. So it could be a misunderstanding that has been sent down from tradition to tradition. But I do think that it is either one person or a group of people that had similar mindset that went to different parts of the world and taught the exact same things. This is why the construction of the pyramids are very similar. This is why the tales of the flood story are very similar. This is why certain things where they had like different pantheons of gods, it is all very similar. So it had to be one person or a group of people that went and taught all of these things. And then obviously, you know, like, because you have, okay, for example, you have like the cargo cults. You ever heard of cargo cults?
I have. You're going to have to refresh the definition for me.
Okay, so there's a group of people in the Pacific that during the Second World War, the American soldiers went there and they were on these islands and they used as bases. So what happened is that they brought the natives like cans of Spam and all kinds of things. And these people, these natives, thought that the American soldiers were gods. So what they did is that they have made runways. They've made planes out of wood. They've made all kinds of like guns. They've made everything to represent their gods, because they don't have the understanding, and they would worship them. They would do rituals and do ceremonies to, so that their gods, the humans, could come back to them, right? Because they were given certain things. So I use that to show that what most likely happened is that they may not have necessarily been gods that are fish. We don't know. But what could have happened is that because of the attire that they're dressed in to represent, you know what I mean, maybe a higher level of consciousness, we don't know, could have been misunderstood, and through all the tales, make it seem like they were actual fish. Because, I mean, let's be honest, like we can't comprehend how a fish could walk on its like fins and come onto the surface and then communicate with humans in a language, you know? So, but when you really delve deep into it, it looks like they were just advanced humans and they had different way of dressing and they probably had certain types of headdress. So that would have been understood that these are like that. And over eon to eon, these stories got tweaked and changed, but there's certain key elements that remained. And I think that that's basically what happened, because we don't know 100%, but we do know that there are a lot of similarities in all of the stories.
Okay, so it sounds like one of the possibilities that we're talking about now is essentially, and I'm going to rephrase it in maybe a dumber way, but like if there was a bunch of aliens or Anunnaki or some other group outside of humans and they all got together, and then the ones that decided we're going to go and spread consciousness, we're going to deliver consciousness to these humans, every one of those on the consciousness team all decide that they're going to dress up like snakes, or they're going to have some kind of snake symbolism, so that no matter where they go on the planet, they basically, that culture starts to correspond the consciousness that they got with some sort of snake deity. So they're all different snake deities, or they're all different, like, snake, you know, people that were able to transfer consciousness. So that's what describes the similarity, is that they all kind of came from the same group and did have the same role in all these different places.
Yes.
Okay. So if we go on this aspect of it, I'm curious on the snake ends up being the one that transfers consciousness. Why do you think it becomes an evil or like an immoral player as time goes on? Like specifically, you know, biblically and like in Christianity, why is it the snake that takes on all of the horrible debt of, you know, sin and evil and Satan? Like, was that done intentionally by someone trying to hide the past of where consciousness came from?
That's a good question. And what it appears is that religion in general is just a lot of dogmatic statements that push a narrative to create a certain mindset in people, which is basically to be slaves. And the reason why I say that is that the word religion comes from the Latin word religare, which means to hold, to bind, or to thwart forward progress of. Now, when you look at the original texts, which are the Sumerian tablets, and that story talking about in the Garden of Eden, it was really when Enki told Eve and that she was actually naked, but not necessarily physically naked. Yes, that was one aspect of her, but it was naked in terms of consciousness. So they did not know anything. They did not know that they were slaves. Now, this story is told in another book called the Book of Jasher, which is also known as the Book of Righteousness. And Adam was telling this story to his son, Seth. And he said to Seth, your mother Eve taught me that the God in the Garden of Eden was not the God of the universe. He was not the creator of the universe. And basically what has happened is that it was a narrative that was put in, because the story of the Anunnaki is very interesting, because they came from a different planet. Their planet, according to them, is called Nibiru. They came and their planet was imploding. They came here to look to mine for gold to send back to their planet. During the process, Enki and Enlil were always at each other, because Enki was the firstborn, but he was born of a consort, and Enlil was the firstborn of the wife of their father, Anu. So there was always conflict between the two brothers. As a consequence, there was a lot of jealousy in between. So what happened is that when Enki created humans in this current form, he did some genetic modifications to us. And what happened then is that we were like proper slaves. So when you go back to these texts, the Garden of Eden was like an open laboratory. The males would only be able to have sex with the women at certain times. It was almost like how you have in a farm, where when the females come in heat, then they would go and get served. It was very much like that. Now, what happened is that Enki had compassion for humanity. He felt for us because he created us. And he felt that it was his duty and debt to try to help us out, try to give us a bit of a nudge. So what happened is that he ended up teaching them that the God in the Garden of Eden is not the creator of all things and is a false God. So what happened then is that Enlil got upset and he got vexed. So the story in Genesis where Adam and Eve were kicked out of the Garden of Eden, this is where that comes from in the Sumerian tablets, where they were expelled from the Garden of Eden because they were seen as traitors, because there were guards that you couldn't even get in and out. So what happened now is that to make Enki look as the bad one, that whole story about the serpent was created. Because if because one of the symbols that Enki had was the serpent, but that was not the only one. His main symbol was water, but the serpent was one of the symbols he had. So in order to discredit Enki, to make him look bad, what they did is that when they created the Bible, because what people don't realize is that the Bible is a culmination of many different books. It's a combination of stuff out in Mahabharata, the Sumerian tablets, stuff in the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's a combination of many different books. And what it is that these books have been handpicked and in most cases redacted and some things changed to create a particular narrative, right? So the narrative would be is that God is this being to be feared. So he is the narrative that's being trying to inject it into our consciousness is, look, that serpent, he's bad. When in reality, he taught us that we were actually slaves, right? And Lil didn't like that. So the narrative created is that snake, he's bad. You must always admonish and try to banish that snake, the serpent, which is the giver of consciousness. So everything in this realm is inverted. Everything. If you just look at how today is, the things that 50 years that we've seen bad, today are good. And today, if you were trying to be like a good person, in some situations that seemed as very bad, you know? So my point is that everything has been inverted. So the reason why the story was inverted to show that the serpent is bad is to create a narrative so that we run away from investigating the serpent, the consciousness, what it represents. Because think about it. If you tell people that the serpent is bad, well, everybody is going to try to avoid it. So then you would still remain ignorant, which is what ignorant means is the lack of knowledge. So this is the reason why.
Again, this is the total devil's advocate question, but I'm trying to follow, like, if I were to follow this logic directly of the Catholic Church essentially inverting and saying, you know, steer away from the snake, steer away from consciousness. At what point, like, my mind goes to, like, okay, Church of Satan, right? Like, that would be the antithesis of the Catholic Church, would be someone advocating to look into dark arts and do black magic and all this stuff. So, like, where does that logic break down, where if everything that we've known about the snake has been to steer us away from consciousness, does that also imply, like, we should all be looking into Luciferianism and Satanism because there might be consciousness and knowledge there that the church is trying to keep away from us? Or is that a false analogy? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
I understand what I'm saying. That's a very interesting question. What I would say is that if people were to investigate Luciferianism and Satanism, I am almost certain they will see a lot of similarities to what is going on in the world. Because think about it, right? Everything is hidden in plain sight, right? So all of the stuff that these people do behind closed doors are being done now in the open, because the best place to hide the truth is in the open. Now, what I would say is that understanding these cults or religions can help you to understand what is in front of you, because those cults are just using a lot of dark energy and dark magic in order to create the world that we're living in. So yes, these people believe in those things. So it doesn't matter if you believe it is real or not. But if you want to understand how the world is being run, you have to understand how these people think. So yes, I would say that if you want to understand, you have to, when they say investigate, but read it with a skeptical mind. But what will happen is when you start to read some of these things, you will realize that, hey, well, this is exactly what we have in the world. So then now, as you start to do more research and trying to find out, you will end up finding that everything is a lie, because all of the information out there is it the public's domain? We have smartphones in our pockets that are like supercomputers at the moment compared to what we had 50, 60 years ago. You know, people, before you were talking about kilobytes, we're talking about terabytes now, you know? So what will happen is that you have to research the dark in order to find the light. And then when you start, the deeper you start to go on the dark, you realize, hold on a minute, everything that they said to us is a lie. So I do agree that there has to be some investigation of those belief systems in order to understand what we live in. Because whether you believe it or not, the people that rule the world believe in it. So you need to understand what they believe so that you can counter what they're trying to do to you. Does that make sense?
It does. And I'm so if we stay on that theme of doing things that, you know, the Christian church would say, don't ever do this, right?
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
So one of those examples of like sitting down and trying to summon a demon, like saying all the Latin phrases and you get your salt and your sages out and you do all the symbols and stuff. In your mind, as an opinion, do you think that any part of that could result in evil happening?
Well, what I would say is that we need to use discernment in certain things, because the reason why I say that is that when you start to dabble in the spirit realm, whether it is good or bad, or how you perceive it, good or bad, you have to have one, someone guiding you through it, because you start to unlock realms of consciousness that you have no experience with. So let me give an example. When you do ayahuasca or you do bufo, which are psychedelics, it is very, very much advised to have a shaman. Why? Because you're going into other realms. You're going into the spirit world, the spirit realm, and you are like a complete novice. This is like you, as in a person that just drives a normal car, sitting in an F1 car, and you're trying to go around the circuit. When you hit the accelerator, the G-force that is going to hit you is going to be so hard that you may not even be able to have the reaction time in order to turn the corner. You may end up crashing. So that's very similar to when, if you're going into the spirit realm, you have to have someone to guide you and to clear the area of energy, because we're dealing with forces that in our particular level of consciousness we have no concept of. We don't know how to manage, how to push back, how to protect. We don't know. So what I'm saying is that you have to use a bit of discernment, where you can't just come and say, hey, well, I'm gonna go and get a Ouija board and go and summon these things here now and stuff, like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you have to use some bit of common sense here, you know? So reading and investigating is one thing, but if you're trying to physically go into the spirit realm like that, I would say some caution needs to be taken.
The ayahuasca example you brought up is an interesting one, just because I have very mixed feelings on it. I don't know if I necessarily, and I feel like I'm in an extreme minority here, but I don't know if it's necessary for everyone to need a shaman or a guide on their first or any of these, just the way, and this is also very controversial, but just the way that I'm not 100% convinced that taking ayahuasca in the heart of the South American rainforest with shamans in Peru is necessarily a whole lot different, at least chemically and in the objective world, than like a high schooler that orders mimosa bark off eBay and then goes to the pool company down the street and uses chemicals to raise and lower the pH until they've crystallized DMT. And then they like smoke it in a piece of tinfoil or something. Like, I understand that the experience of those two things is different, but I feel like I truly am on the fence that just because some new age soccer mom spent $4,000 to go to Peru and have that experience versus some high schooler that's dabbling and spent $80 online. I feel that there's just as much chance that that $80 dabbler might end up having a far more spiritual experience and maybe come away with like a higher level of consciousness than the lady that goes and talks to the shaman. Like, and all things not being equal here, but I always wonder on those two different extremes, right? Like, if you go and you pay the tour guide and you do all the penance and they tell you, oh, say these prayers and fast for this amount of time and only eat these organic things versus some dude that's been slamming, you know, beers and eating gummy worms and just smokes a little bit of DMT. I don't know. Like, do you think that the guy that's eating gummy worms and drinking beer and smoking DMT off the internet could potentially have a better spiritual experience than someone that went through all the steps and went to Peru?
It's hard to say, and I'll tell you the reason why. I have done a lot of psychedelics. I've done peyote, ayahuasca, bufal varius.
Salvia?
No, not yet.
Oh, God. I'm still looking for my salvia buddy out there. They're out there somewhere.
And what I would say is that when you're going into the spirit realm, there are a lot of things that you need to consider. One, your intention. Two, the ambience that you're in. So what tends to happen is that during ceremonies, they clean the area energetically. And then three, the type of, I don't want to necessarily say music, but frequency music. Because like with ayahuasca, you have what you call Icarus. The shaman would sing Icarus. In bufal varius ceremonies, they tend to have like that type of healing music. Same, and then in, when you do mushroom ceremonies, they tend to have music that is of a certain, frequency to help you to expand, right? So the reason why I say all that is to say is that if you have zero experience in terms of, or you want to do it on your own, you have no understanding about going into the spiritual realm, and you are taking other substances at the same time, you're listening to heavy rock, heavy metal, very dark.
Yeah, throw on some Wu-Tang or something. Take some mushrooms.
Yeah, exactly. It can have severe consequences because I spoke to someone before and they told me that their stepson basically went mad because, you know what I mean, he smoked some weed after taking magic mushrooms. And then most probably, they don't know, the music that they were playing would not have been very conducive to having an expansive trip, right? Because what it is now is that this is why I say that you have to have experience. You have to have someone to guide you on the process. Yes, you can do it on your own. I'm not saying you can't, but we are playing with forces that we don't know. We have no day-to-day contact with. That's why it was said about it. You take a person that just drives a normal car and put them in an F1 car, most likely they'll probably kill themselves or crash, right? Because they don't have the training. They don't have the guidance on how to drive.
Well, see, that's a fair analogy when it's a machine that has like that's foreign to all of us. But I think once it gets into the mental realm, like we all have our own Formula One car. If we're going to say, you know, being able to have introspective psychedelic experiences, in my mind, like we've always all had the F1 cars in our garages. It's just some of us have never bothered to turn it on. I guess in a way it's reminding me a little bit of some of the argument against religion where growing up Roman Catholic, right? My entire purview of religion was that you can't necessarily understand this. Like this wasn't written for you. And even if it was, like we've got people that have interpreted it for you. You talk to your pastor, you talk to the cardinal at the certain level, you get all the way up to the Pope and you ask the Pope what he thinks, as opposed to you ever thinking that you could figure it out yourself, because the Pope represents not just a communion with God, but that he's been sitting on like thousands of years of research and the science is settled in a certain way about like the whole Vatican Library aspect of this. And I guess part of the same reason that I've felt very like rebellious against that, like rejecting that there's like this one dude that's got the final answer. Like, who's that guy? Like, why is he the one? I almost feel a similar way towards like the shaman aspect or like the new age spirit guides, in that it feels almost like there's a religious aspect of like, no, don't go and try talking to God solo. Like, you gotta listen to me first, because I've done it before, so follow in my footsteps. And I guess my fear of that is that, great, but what if your footsteps took like this path that I didn't want to take? I wanted to take a hard left here and make that mistake and learn a different thing. I don't, there's not a point or even a contention here, but it's that I always feel weary of anyone that tries to represent themselves as any kind of authority figure, even if that just amounts to being your shaman spirit guide. Part of my rebellious nature is like, screw you. You're like, you're not a shaman spirit guide. What do you know? Even if they know, you know what I mean?
I understand what you're saying, but what I would say is that with psychedelics, again, you are going into the spiritual realm. And the only time we really go into the spiritual realm is when we're asleep. So during our waking hours, we don't have contact with the spiritual realm. Now, in the spiritual realm, because you're dealing with the mind, you can manifest things in your mind. You can create things. You can encounter entities and stuff. Now, if you have sort of like the wrong ambience, a very heavy, dark, dense, but you having a psychedelic experience or you're entering the spiritual realm, you're going to be influenced by that. You're going to make it much, much harder. I have seen people get violent or want to get physically violent during psychedelics, and everything was done right. But what it is now is that they had guys to restrain him. But what it was now is that because the guys restrained him, they told him, let's just breathe in and out, breathe. Then he was able to come down. But if you are doing it by yourself and you go and you have these influences, like with the music, or you're smoking weed or drinking alcohol, other psychoactivants inside of your body, you can have a very, very bad trip, right? And what can happen now is that can cause you now to maybe have a massive shock in your mind, and you can actually go mad, for lack of a better word, right? Well, now, in most cases, if you have a shaman, certain protocols are going to be followed to keep you as safe as possible. You understand? Because the mind is, like you said, it's the most powerful thing we have. It's like the Ferrari, you know, the sitting down there, you know, that we don't really use, right? It's so powerful, right? It's like an F1 car, like you were saying, sorry. So my point is that certain protocols need to be put in place. And if you know the protocols, you can actually do it yourself, right? Because like, I have a friend that he was studying to become a shaman. And in part of his training, he would have to do bufo on his own, right? So I'm not saying that you can't do these things on your own.
Is it like licking a toad, or is there a more civilized way to do it?
No, you smoke it. So what they do is they take the venom from the toad, they dry it, they crystallize it, and then you put it in a pipe and you smoke it. So he used to do it on his own, right? So I'm not saying you can't do these things on your own, but there's a certain protocol that you would need to follow. Because when you go into the spirit realm, when you are in there, you can get a shock out your life. You could see, like you said, you could get in contact with a demon. But the demon in reality may actually just be you, you know, projecting certain energies into your consciousness due to the influence of maybe, one, you didn't have an intention, two, the music you're listening to, three, you didn't clean the space, four, you're drinking or smoking weed or doing other, psychoactive drugs, right? So all of these can cause you a bad trip. And if you have a bad trip, you don't know how you're going to react, because you're not, I don't want to say sane, but you're not having all of your faculties in that present moment. You understand? So you can do something maybe to yourself or to someone. So that's the only reason why I'm saying that, not that you can't do it on your own, but it's best to have a shaman. And if you want to do it on your own, just have the protocols to follow, because you have to be taught these things, because these the way the ceremonies are done is for a particular reason, in order to make you have a safe journey and come back. You understand?
Yeah, and actually, I think that the most rational middle ground there between the extremes of do it by yourself, no training, just go in blind, which I'm not advocating for. But don't just go and order some random research chemical and do it by yourself and hope for the best, versus going and doing the entire ceremony. Somewhere in between the middle of those, I think the perfect version of that is what I'd call like a babysitter, which is usually on like salvia is a good example, where it's almost universally recommended that you have a sitter versus necessarily like a shaman or a guide, in that a sitter is just there to make sure that you don't poke yourself in the eye or jump out a window. And like, that's kind of your friend that starts having a violent reaction. That's someone there to say, it's okay, this is normal, breathe, so that that person in isolation doesn't work themselves up and make it into something that it doesn't need to be. Just let them know, hey, this is just a wave. It's just a passing wave. And as long as you ride the wave out, it'll be fine again. If you don't have that reassurance in a sitter, then things can go really horrible. But a sitter, I guess, in my mind is very passive, in that they're not trying to tell you like what to expect or how to prepare yourself or what music to play. And this is all devil's advocate, okay? Like, because actually I more believe that you should have a shaman / spirit guide. But these are like my doubts that I'm expressing and almost taking as like my main point, which it isn't. But that, like, if we were to say, okay, get a shaman spirit guide, I'm going to take mushrooms for the first time in my life, right? Or whatever, LSD or whatever. And you're like, you should definitely go get a spirit guide. Well, I could, if I just threw a dart at all the spirit guides that are available to me, one of them might want to just put on like Grateful Dead and have us watch cartoons and like talk about feelings. And that might be very applicable to them. Another one might be like, no, let's go outside in nature and like play acoustic guitar, or just play drums or something. And, you know, look at insects and look at how the light bounces off stuff. One person might say, no, let's go and look at abstract art in a museum, or let's go socialize. Like, and all of these might be the right thing for all those different people, but it's such a personal, unique experience that it's like, how would you even know your first time out if your shaman's going to be the stay inside and watch cartoon shaman, or it's going to be go outside and explore and climb a mountain shaman? And like, by making that wrong decision, it could almost ruin somebody's entire experience with even having spirit guides in general. It's like, oh no, that sucked. They just played Grateful Dead for 4 hours and I hated it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. So I would say that anyone that's looking to do psychedelics, ayahuasca, bufo, peyote, you know, some research should be done on the person and the shaman and the place, and, you know what I mean, talk to people that have done it with those people and stuff, if you can, because, I mean, you have a point, because, you know, you could go with a person that claims they're a shaman and they could be just a snake salesman and just come in and nick your money and give you some old piece of watered down something and you don't even get the experience, or gives it to you too strong and then you freak out. So,
or if it's like a concert, if like, let's say they're all good shamans, but one of them wants to bring you to the rock concert and one wants to bring you to the concert, and like,
I would be very, very, if any shaman wants to do that, I'd be very suspect of them. I would actually.
Well, I'm talking American shamans here. We haven't gone into Peru yet. So actually, that's another question I wanted to ask you. Because whenever someone says doing ayahuasca and finding a shaman and a spirit guide, I assume that they're basically flying into Peru at some point and doing this in Peru. But are there other places in the world that you can, you know, fly to as a foreigner and find a shaman and go on like a spirit journey that's not Peru?
Yeah, Mexico.
Anywhere else? Anywhere other than South America?
I have been told by some people that they do it in the States, ayahuasca, but because it is so, how should I put it? You have to be very, very discreet about it, because.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I guess, like, is there anywhere else you can openly do it? Like, yeah, I'm flying. Like, you can tell people, I'm going to Brazil. Peru. I'm going to do an ayahuasca retreat.
Brazil.
Brazil. Okay. So it's mostly not, South America. South America's worth that, basically.
But yeah, because that part of the world, to be fair, things like that, they are more cultural because they were indigenous practices. So most of those countries tend to be a little bit less stringent on them than, say, first world countries. So, like, you know, if you were, for example, if you were in England and you were advertising that you do ayahuasca, you would probably be shut down very, very quickly. I'm sure it would probably be like that in the States as well, right?
By the government, you mean?
Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. But here in, you know what I mean? Like, if you go to Latin America, dude, it's almost like, to be honest, most Latino people, most people in Central and South America, they don't even care about psychedelics, you know, to be honest with you. Most people would actually think you're a bit crazy for doing them, right? And because they just don't care, it's mostly foreigners and expats that are actually more into it than them.
Yeah, totally true. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, it's called narco-tourism by some governments where if you travel for the explicit point of doing drugs legally, I think it's called narco-tourism. And it's pretty much Europeans and Americans.
You know what I mean? Because
it's the only places that you're not allowed to do it. You know what I mean? So right. You have to go to places where you are.
And you know, it just comes back like to the psychology. If you tell people you can't do something, you're more or less not forcing, but you're more encouraging them to do it. It's like if you tell a baby, don't eat that. Most likely the baby's just going to disobey and going to eat it. So you have to, I am more in favor of using education. Excuse me. So, you know, you can say, well, I wouldn't advise to eat it, but if you were to eat it, you know, you probably get sick or this will happen and blah, blah, blah. So I think that educating people on things is a way better route to go than to have hard, fast prohibition, because prohibition doesn't work. And two, it just makes it more sought after, you know? So
do you think there's a spiritual use for cocaine?
I wouldn't say a spiritual use, but what I would say is that cocaine is nothing new. Cocaine is a drug that has been existence from way back when. And we know that because there was a mummy that had an autopsy done on it a few years ago. I think it was like 2017 or something, or even maybe earlier, I can't remember. But they found traces of cocaine in the mummy.
Well, that mummy might still be alive today if it said no to drugs.
Well, we talking about a few thousand years ago, you know what I mean? And so I would say is that, you know what's the mad thing about cocaine? Cocaine, while is addictive, is actually, hear me out here, is not as bad as sugar. Cocaine, you would have a high and then you crack on, you go and do what you're going to do. Most people. I'm talking most people. Yes, there are some people that are addicted to cocaine that they need it all the time. But you tend to find that those are more people with a bit more money because it's not very cheap. But sugar is actually way more addictive, right? Look at children and sweets. Then look at adults and junk food. We are addicted to sugar. And the thing is that we eat sugar every single day. While cocaine, people that use cocaine for the most part, I'm talking the majority don't use cocaine every day. One is legal, one is illegal.
Yeah, I wonder if we swapped the prices and the legality, like what would happen? Would people be healthier overall if cocaine were cheap and legal and sugar was expensive and illegal?
Dude, that's a very good question. I've never even...
Like they put it back in Coca-Cola, right? So they take out all the sugar, so now there's no sugar in Coke, but they put the cocaine back in. Is that... On a net basis, is that better for society or worse?
Well, the thing is that if you actually have pure cocaine, it actually doesn't do anything to the body per se. What really makes cocaine very bad is what they cut it with. So if you cut in cocaine with all these additives, you know what I mean, that's what brings the bad effects. But cocaine will just pass up through the body, literally, like within a day, 2 days max is out of your system. And I guess something that is so readily available, I doubt people will want to do it all the time. But sugar is mad because cocaine doesn't actually make you fat. Yes, it is addictive, but it doesn't actually make you fat. It doesn't actually affect your health per se. Like, you know, you have health issues, you know what I mean? Like, okay, you may have some issues with like maybe your nose because you snort a lot, but if you're finding ways to get it in your system other than that, like where you say putting it in the drinks on one example, who knows? We don't have any actual data on it. But with the sugar, the more sugar you eat, the more sugar you want. The fatter you get, the lazier you become. And then the lazier you become, the more your mind starts to think in negative ways of being, you know, think negatively. So I would argue that sugar is worse for the body than cocaine. But it's an interesting thought. Who knows? In the world that we're going in right now, I doubt that will ever happen because what we do know is that the rulers of this planet use illicit drugs as their way to do their black budget work and also to keep humans in control and check. And there's I read a very interesting book recently. It talked about the Committee of 300, and the Committee of 300 appears to be the top dogs that rule everything. 300 families that rule the entire planet. And
what do you think about artificial sweeteners? Like just non-caloric sweeteners.
They're actually worse.
What about stevia?
No, pure stevia, very good. Just like pure monk fruit. So what I would say to people is that if your stevia is not green and it's not in a powder, that's not real stevia. The stevia that you see that looks like crystals, if you actually read the labeling well, it actually has sugar in it. They actually take sugar and mix it with the stevia to get these quotation mark stevia crystals. So in reality, you're not really doing yourself anything. Because I got tricked when I first started to use stevia until I actually, like, one day out of curiosity, I just picked it up and I just read the back and I was like, it only had in like 20% stevia. 80% was with stable sugar.
Do you use stevia now?
Yes.
Are there any, and you said monk fruit too. Are there any other sugar replacements that you suggest aside from stevia and monk fruit?
You can use agave, which comes from the cactus, or you can use maple syrup, but maple syrup, which is the pure maple syrup with not all the additives. Again, if you go and take maple syrup and you look and read at the back, you will be amazed at how much sugar is in it. Like, obviously, because I'm into fitness and I teach people how to get into shape and stuff, you know, I do a lot of reading of labels for my own food. And I remember I looked at a chocolate 2 weeks ago. The chocolate was 100 grams weight, and it had 46.8 grams of sugar. So almost half the chocolate, the content was just sugar alone. That's savage, right? So that's why I say that I think, you know, I mean, sugar is worse than cocaine because, like, it is so addictive. Like, look at people that use a lot of sugar. Look how much sugar they put in their tea and their coffee. They drink Coca-Cola. They're having all these muffins and sweets and candies. Everything is just involved in sugar, and it's actually terrible for the body. It just slows down your metabolism. You get like these sugar rushes. So what happens is you will get this massive burst of energy, and then all of a sudden you will have this drop off. And this is one of the reasons to why some people tend to overeat, because after they had that high, then they come down, then they have to eat something again to get that high again because of the sugar, right? So it causes massive mood swings, you know, just like a children. Look at how, like, their moods change. They become super hyperactive because all this ADHD and all these other things that they say that children will have, if you take away the sugar from them and feed them proper food and tell them go and play, most of the conditions would be would be sorted out.
What about if someone just wants to eat like 10 pineapples a day and get their sugar fix through just nonstop fruit? Is that any better or worse than just having like a few sodas a day?
That's a very good question. So what I would say is that at the end of the day, sugar, sugar. So what will happen is that you will still have the same effects, but the natural sugar, which comes in the form of glucose and fructose, is a much better form for the body. But because it is still sugar, right, it will still have the same effect on you that you would, you would end up putting on weight, and you would still end up getting, you wouldn't necessarily get the highs, but what it is now is that you wouldn't feel as satiated than having something that doesn't have as much sugar. But they're good for health, but obviously overindulgence still is the same. You have the same consequence. That's my point.
I remember when I was in the military and we had to make weight for different specific roles that you had to be in and like different merits. But one of the guides that I got from the nutritionist there was essentially avoid anything white, which basically meant like no white bread, no white rice, no white pasta. Like essentially, unless it's a vegetable, if it's white, then you avoid it because it breaks down into a simple sugar at some point. So as like a blanket rule, and it seemed to work, even though it eliminates a large variety of foods out there. Is that accurate? Or do you have any other like really specific, like all encompassing rules that seem to be true? But yes. First of all, does that sound accurate to you?
Yes, it does. So for me personally, I don't eat bread. Very, very rare. Very rare. So me personally, one, I don't buy bread at all. Now, there are certain types of bread I would eat, and those would be like rye bread if I felt like eating bread, or it would have to be like organic bread. Now, the reason why I mostly don't eat bread is that most of the flour on the market is not organic, right? So the main issue with flour is that it's not organic. And the reason why I say this is that if you go back 50, 60 years ago, most people used to eat a lot of bread, but they weren't necessarily fat. And the reason why they became fat is because of two things. One, they had a lot, they changed the flour to be GMO. And then also by doing that, what it did is that it starts to tax your hypothalamus. And your hypothalamus is responsible for hormonal control in the body. So what it is that the hypothalamus becomes stressed. So this is what causes cortisol to be released in the body, and this is what causes you to get fatter, right? So to be fair, eating bread is not bad. But the caveat is if you have organic bread, it doesn't make a difference. So the nutritionist is right to a degree, because the white breads come from white flour, and that flour is bleached, right? So all of the nutritional value is taken out of it. Now, the whole wheat is better, but then you still have the situation is, one, is it organic or not? And two, the level of sugar, the amount of sugar that is in bread anyway, right? And what I would say is that if you are eating bread and you're feeling bloated afterwards, most likely it's not organic, right? Because humans have been eating bread for thousands and thousands of years. And it's only now in this last, 50, 60 years that we've had obesity problems. Like when you look back at most countries, you look back at pictures of people, very few people were actually fat, right? And there's a lot of reasons for that. So even like potatoes and everything that we have today, for the most part, is not organic. So that is one of the big reasons. Now, if you want to eat bread and eat those kind of things, what I would say is that you have to reduce the amounts. So I take a bit more of an extreme stance where you just don't eat bread. But obviously, if I'm out and I have to eat bread, and I obviously I'm hungry, I'm going to eat. But I tend to avoid bread as much as possible, me personally, so I don't buy it. I probably eat bread maybe 4 or 5 times a year, if that. But yes, what your nutritionist is saying is true. But that's because the flour is bleached. So research how white flour is made. You know what I mean? Even
There's a really good book called Sugar Blues that goes into a lot of this, and how like the Sugar Blues talks about how sugar was kind of foisted upon a lot of people just because it was so profitable and it made it so much easier to sell cheaper food for more money. And people would prefer it over the healthier, cheaper food. But like, it also goes into rice and white rice for the same reason. They bleach it and they husk it. And just by doing that process of husking the rice eliminates like almost all the medical benefits of even eating rice. So when you're left with just regular white rice, it's described as basically just sugar. You're just like, you're eating it now, and then an hour later it's actual sugar. Like you could have just like had a soda versus white rice or a piece of white bread. But it's scary too, though, because if you look at any cheap food in the States, at least, it's pretty much going to be loaded with rice, bread, or corn. Like one of those three things is going to be like the majority of what makes it up, and the rest, or soy, and the rest of it is kind of filled in with the proteins and all the other ingredients. So it's very much an uphill battle. Like when you say, you know, just don't eat bread, like that's basically like 90% of the things on any menu. And then even the ones that are left over, you're going to be picking off like croutons, or you're going to be picking off the breading on something that was added to something that's technically doesn't come with bread, but it's got bread as an ingredient.
That is so true. You know, it is, when you actually look at it, it is a very big conspiracy to make people sick, because there's no money in healthy people. There's no money in dead people, but there's a lot of money in between. Just having people sick enough to keep selling them drugs. So everything that we have in our world today is about to drive profit for the corporations. So honestly, right, the way I feel personally when I go and look at chocolate, I love chocolate, but I hardly buy chocolate, hardly. Because when I look at it, right, I'm like, this is 50% sugar almost. And I'm like, I might as well just take a bag of sugar and just eat it like that instead, you know? And that it's just a travesty when you actually understand food. So what it is now is that everything that is in our food supply now has been done deliberately to make us fatter and make us sicker, make us more dependent, make us slower, make us more ignorant. This is why you have fluoride in the toothpaste and fluoride in the water, so that we're more passive. You give us cheap food that has zero nutritional value. But what it does is that because it's cheap, we buy it, because what they've done is that they've eroded the purchasing power of the money. So after 1971, I think it's August 17th or 21st, 22, when Nixon took the United States off the gold standard, what ended up happening is that all the currencies in the world became fiat currencies, because the dollar had gold as its backing, so it was money. So everyone used to base their currency on the dollar. But if you have a total fiat system, the only way for the fiat system to survive is to create more debt. And what you do is, the more debt you create, the more money you have in circulation, the less purchasing power of that particular currency. So this is why, if you look at from 1971 to 2024, the United States dollar has lost probably 98% of its purchasing power, right? So what that means is that things have become 99% more expensive compared to it was back in 1971. So what that means now is that this is the whole grand conspiracy. By making the purchasing power of the dollar go down, Then you make food that is bad for you cheaper. By default, people that are disadvantaged or don't work for a lot of money are going to more tend to buy the cheaper food because they're trying to save a buck. Now, what that's going to do is that that's going to make people sicker and fatter. So the money that they have left back, they have to go and buy medication. Or worst case scenario, they become so sick that they have to get supported by the state. So what this all it is to create a bunch of dependents, right? So that these people that rule the world can keep controlling us. And then what they do is that they poison our minds by all the stuff that they put on the TV. So what it does now is that you have the father is no longer able to support the family on his wages. The mother has to go into the workforce. When the mother goes in the workforce, who's taking care of the children? You either have nurseries or the TV. The TV is what's taking care of the children. So therefore, now you can indoctrinate the young generation. Mommy and daddy are too stressed out, too worried about trying to provide for the family. So what they're doing now is that they're going to buy food not for health, but for survival, right? So you have this cycle that is going on. When you fast forward that plan a little bit more, they introduce crack and drugs into the ghetto. Then they actually give the young males weapons so that they go to war with each other. You create gang violence. What does this do? The fathers who are trying to provide for their families end up going to prison and leaves the mother on her own. It's not that a mother can't raise children on her own, but without a father figure who's going to teach the boys discipline, teach the daughters respect for men, you end up having a debaucherous society. You have feminized men. You end up having masculine women because the women have to step up to the plate, which is not their normal default role. The daughters are going to be like, well, I don't want to be like my mother. So they're going to, in thinking, well, I can do better. I can go and get educated and get a good job. That is good. But what's going to happen now is that for a few years down the line, because most men are bums, these highly educated women are not going to procreate or have partners because the caliber of man that they want is in the 1 or 10%, right? So you have this cycle that is this, it's not even a cycle. You have this grand plan that was done, which started from devaluing the dollar. And some other things happened in society where you had feminism, which started in like 1967. You had abortions becoming legal and stuff. You add all these things together. This was a step-by-step process to weaken humanity. And the main objective was to take the males and the fathers out the house. So there are no positive male role models. So when you have no strong men, you have a weak society. And it's not the women's job to push back against these things. It is the man's job. The man is supposed to protect and provide and give security. But if the men want to be women and the women want to be men, we're too confused and trying to be something that we're not, that we're just getting more and more enslaved. We're getting fatter and fatter, and we're getting dumber and dumber. And the schools are just there to teach propaganda and, you know what I mean, critical race theory and all these things about these 92 different genders. And then you have stuff where it's like, you know, they want to brainwash people that communism is good. You know what I mean? Everything that we were talking about earlier, everything is so inverted, but it has been a step by step by step by step process, which is akin to killing the frog by putting him in cold water and just turning up the heat. Gradually, he's getting hotter and hotter, and he's not going to know. And this is actually what you call a Fabianistic approach to destroying the society, because the people that rule the world, a lot of this thought process has come up to the Fabian Institute. So a lot of these people are Fabianists, you know? So it goes really, really deep. But my point here is that, you know, everything has been rigged against us, and we have to look to take care of ourselves mentally, spiritually, and physically. We have to get our body in shape. So what we need to do is we need to eat better, eat organic food or more naturally produced food. We need to start to work on our mindset. We need to start to stop listening to the media and start listening to these politicians, because they're only there to sow division amongst us, make us fight against one another, and not realize that they are the enemy. And then three, you need to work on yourself spiritually. You need to, how should I say, put down the religious books and think that they're the arbiters of 100% truth, and read different books, other religious books, other books that have been taken out of the Bible, other books that are supposedly frowned upon, like the Nag Hammadi, which are the Gnostic books. Then you start to go down to the Book of Enoch, the Bhagavad Gita. When you start to read all these books now, you start to realize, hold on a minute, this is a grand conspiracy, because everything leads back to spirituality. Everything. And this is a spiritual war that we're in, and we're fighting for our lives here. So, you know, it's not just one thing. So sugar is just one aspect, but there are a lot of different aspects. Fluoridating the toothpaste, they're corrupting our minds with the TV, social media has men to become simps and women to become whores. So what we have now, you have women that just promoting a lot of debauchery, and then you've got the weak simp men that giving these women their money. These women want certain caliber of men, but they can't get those men, because a man that has principle isn't going to be wifing up a whore. And then these women making all this money, but they're still lonely and sad because they don't have any partners, right? So we have a very inverted world, is the point I'm trying to make, you know?
Well, I'll leave it at that, because that was a great, I can't top any of that. So I know that you said that you were going to be doing your own podcast pretty soon. So let's just pretend that that's already up and running, and tell people where they can find that if it is up and running.
Yes, I'm actually going to start it in June. So it's going to be called The Conscious Man. And I'm looking forward to doing it, because like
the Conscious Man or the Conscious Mind?
The Conscious Man.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm going to be talking about a whole different array of stuff. 100% fitness, nutrition, exercise, spirituality, consciousness, geopolitics, current affairs, spirituality, you know, the Anunnaki or hidden, our ancient hidden history, and all of these things, because in reality, they're all linked. They're all linked. And I never realized that until, like, you know, when I first started to get into podcasting, which was like 2 years ago. And it really, I knew it at the back of my head, but it was only like, excuse me, when I had to speak about these things publicly, that the shoe dropped for me, or the pin dropped, as we say in England. I was like, these are all linked, you know? And I just started to research more and more and more all these things. So I would tell people that the first thing to do is to start to work on yourself.
Ready for a cosmic conspiracy about Stanley Kubrick, moon landings, and the CIA? Go visit NASAComic.com.
NASAComic.com, CIA's biggest con. Stanley Kubrick put us on, that's why we're singing this song. I'm NASAComic.com. Go visit NASAComic.com. Go visit NASAComic.com. Yeah, go visit NASAComic.com. Oh, NASAComic.com, CIA's biggest con. Stanley Kubrick put us on, that's why we're singing this song. I'm NASAComic.com. Go visit NASAComic.com. Go visit NASAComic.com. Yeah, go visit NASAComic.com.
Never a Straight Answer is a 40-page comic about Stanley Kubrick directing the Apollo space missions. This is the perfect read for comic, Kubrick, or conspiracy fans of all ages. For more details, visit nasacomic.com.
Paranoid. Scribble my life away, driven to write the page. Will it enlight your brain? Give you the flight, my plane. Paper, the highs ablaze. Somewhat of an amazing feel when it's real to real. You will engage it. Your favorite, of course, the lord of an arrangement. I gave you the proper results to hit the pavement. If they get emotional, hate, maybe your language, a game. How they playing it well without Lakers. Evade them, whatever the cost, they are the shapeshift. Snakes get decapitated, met is the apex. Execution of flame, you out. Nuclear bomb distributed at war, rather gruesome for eyes to see. Max them out, then I light my trees. Blow it off in the face. You're despising me for what though? Calculated and rather cutthroat. Paranoid American must be all the blood smoke for real. Lord, give me a day away, vacate. They wait around to hate whatever they say. Man, it's not in the least bit. We get heavy rotate when a beat hits. So thank us, you're welcome. Fuck the niggas for real. You're welcome. They ain't never had a deal. You welcome, man, they lacking appeal. You welcome, yet they doing it still. You welcome.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.